Hello and welcome to Worlds Apart. Strategic autonomy is the ability of a state or a group of states to pursue their interest or foreign policy goals without depending too much on foreign powers. It's a bit similar to the psychological definition of maturity, the adult ability to fend for itself. And according to my guest today, it is something that the European Union has lost the sight and the grip of in the midst of the Ukrainian conundrum. What can possibly bring it back? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined from Paris by Jacques Sapir, director of the School for Advanced Studies in the Social Sciences. Professor Sapir, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Now, I heard you say that the EU's decision to support Ukraine was emotional rather than rational. And I wonder what's underneath those emotions. Is it ultimately about Ukraine and what's best for Ukraine? Or is it more about Europe and its own issues?
Well, when I wrote that it was an emotional decision, I was focusing on to the fact that, of course, the very idea of a war now in Europe would have raised a lot of emotions. I was not critical on this emotion. What I wrote also was the fact that this emotion would have to be balanced by a true strategic analysis of what was happening, and that exactly what the EU didn't do and is still not doing. We know and we understand that this war is a war of attrition with considerable human and material cost on both sides. And the most important thing now is first to try to achieve a ceasefire and to try to achieve a kind of reasonable agreement between both sides.
Can I stop you here? Because you talk about both sides, and I'm sure you know that this conflict is seen in Russia as not a war between Moscow and Kyiv, but rather as a conflict that involves many sides. And it's essentially, for Moscow at least, a proxy war between Russia and the West. So when you talk about reconciliation and peace talks, what powers are you talking about?
In a conflict, you have two sides. Each side could be, of course, divided into different parts. But a conflict is basically something which happens between two sides. And in the Ukrainian side, I am talking not just of Ukraine, but also of countries which are supporting Ukraine. Nevertheless, there is a problem of decision-making. And either Ukraine has still its own decision-making. So the decision to either agree on a ceasefire or to open discussions with Russia will be a Ukrainian decision. Or Ukraine has no more its ability to make a decision. And then the decision is to be made by country which supports Ukraine. The problem is that these countries have said at many times that the decision will be a Ukrainian decision. So we have, there is, and you are right to point to the problem. Nevertheless, we need a kind of decision-making, and I think that by adopting a much more reasonable thinking about this conflict, the EU, NATO, the United States could have opened more choice and more room to maneuver for the government of Ukraine.
Now, Professor Sapir, let me come back to your point about the EU supporting Ukraine for emotional or rather irrational reasons. I don't have any studies to support that, but intuitively, I think there is a strong correlation between the EU's own internal problems, be it debt issue or bureaucratic hurdles, and its support for the anti-Russian or pro-Western, pro-EU orientation. It's almost like Ukraine's westward orientation is being used as a psychoprop to allay the EU's own self-doubt or its own structural difficulties. And I've seen this trend all the way since the early 2010s, but definitely so in 2012 and 2013. Do you think there's any truth to that?
Well, the EU as such was probably not existing in 2014. You had countries, part of the EU, Germany, France, Great Britain, I said, which was a part of the EU. And these countries have different agendas. Now, it is also a fact that some European bureaucrats, not, you know, the Council of Members, but some European bureaucrats have seen in events happening in Ukraine, the Maidan and all this kind of uprising, they have seen something extremely important for the European ideas, and they have pushed, and of course, it is well known, these bureaucrats came to the Maidan demonstrations, but the real decision-making force in the EU was still the council of the head of the state, the prime minister, president, and so forth. And there was no commitment, no real commitment of the EU in support of Ukraine, but a quite general commitment.
Yeah, we are just for the basic democracy. Lip service or, you know, responding to flattery. Now, can I ask you something about Russia? Because Russia was never, historically at least, and in recent times as well, was never antithetical to Europe. We also idolized Western Europe for quite some time, not only after the Cold War, but even before that. Probably we were not as sycophantic as the Ukrainians, but there was a great degree of reverie and fascination with Western Europe. We sold you our mineral riches at very cheap prices. Why do you think it was never reciprocated? And why do you think this enmity towards Russia is so strong? Because, you know, it's one thing to criticize Russia or disagree with its policy, but to portray it in terms as, you know, the ultimate evil, and this is what we are hearing now from many European leaders, this is something very surprising to us, despite all this long history of wars between Russia and European countries.
As a matter of fact, relationships between Russia and the EU have been constantly biased by relationship with Russia and countries of the EU. This is not the same thing. You had a French-Russia relationship, German-Russia relationship, even Great Britain-Russia. Okay. The problem was that by 2014, the relevance of this bilateral relationship was certainly stronger than it was now. And now you have, because of this emotional reaction, a kind of commitment of the EU as a whole on a distant policy. And of course, this policy is extremely and violently anti-Russia. Nevertheless, you can still hear in government of country member of the EU storm discording voice. And the real problem is the fact that nobody knows what is the EU. Is it just an alliance of countries, and then you had to let these countries to decide of a position before having an EU position? Or is the EU a kind of federation with all the countries being like states in the United States, you know? And when you are coping with the United States policy, what thing as a governor of California or of New Mexico doesn't matter.
With all due respect to these voices of reason, the European Union is supplying arms against my country, and people of my country, soldiers of my country, are being killed. And by the way, not only of Russia, but also of Ukraine. This war is being prolonged thanks to the supply of weapons from across Europe. And more than that, we are hearing official leaders of Europe supporting the war against Russia until the end, whatever that end may mean. And they are defining it in very crusade-like terms, in very ontological terms. It's a battle against an ultimate evil. Do you think the EU has the resources, the minds, the hearts, the treasure, the soldiers, the skills, the capacities to win that war against Russia? Because if history is anything to go by, you know, such efforts by various Western countries didn't really bode well for them, in the past at least.
Well, if we look to this issue, clearly the EU has not the ability, be it industrial or military, to wage a war or to support the kind of war which is waged now in Ukraine. That's absolutely clear. The stocks of ammunition have been considerably depleted. I think that in Germany, it's less than 2 days of war, probably the same in France. Some militaries are even saying we just have just 1 day of ammunition left. Okay. But the main problem is that no one is really admitting that. So this is a very, very important problem. And this is why I say, at one time or another, some ceasefire and some agreement will have to be reached. And it is not reasonable to make a commitment onto a highly ontological position, like to say Ukraine is
humanity's last hope for goodness. That's essentially how it's portrayed.
All its sovereignty. We know that it will not be the case. And actually, we had an example, an historical example, the war between Finland and the Soviet Union, both in 1940. And in 1944, the Finlandese government acknowledged the fact that the cost of war, the human cost of war, was much too high and decided to negotiate with Soviet Union, even in accepting some loss of territories.
Well, Professor Sapir, unfortunately, I think your opponents would tell you that the new government of Finland has since abandoned this kind of logic. But let's return to this very topic after a very short break. We will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
So what we've got to do is identify the threats that we have.
It's crazy.
Confrontation, let it be an arms race.
Who is on offense? Very dramatic development.
I personally am going to resist.
I don't see how that strategy will be successful.
Very critical time.
Time to sit down and talk.
Hi, I'm Rick Sanchez, and I'm here to plead with you, whatever you do, do not watch my new show. Seriously, why watch something that's so different? Why listen to opinions that you won't get anywhere else? Look, if it pleases you to have the State Department, the CIA, weapons makers, multi-billion dollar corporations choose your facts for you, go ahead. Why change? And whatever you do, don't watch my show. Stay mainstream, because I'm probably going to make you uncomfortable. My show is called Direct Impact. But again, you probably don't want to watch it because it might just change the way you think.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Jacques Sapir, director of the School for Advanced Studies in the Social Sciences in Paris. Professor Sapir, before the break, you were talking about neutrality and the conscious, deliberate, calculated decision on the part of the post-war authorities in Finland to choose what's best for its own country and to treat neutrality and security as you know, as actual matters of policy. But I think the problem with the European Union is what some Russian scientists call value radicalization or even value fundamentalism, because no moral code other than European or Western moral code is accepted. And I think that's one of the reasons why Russia, China, and, you know, everybody else who disagrees with the West are treated as, you know, ultimate axis of evil. What can possibly change that? And what do you see as the root cause of this phenomenon when, you know, I'm the only source of goodness and wisdom, and if you disagree with me, then you are my eternal enemy?
Well, I think that we have to retreat from these value fundamentalism. It's absolutely obvious. And I think that we will retreat just because we don't have the ability to support Ukraine for very long in the war as it is fought right now. I think that the important turning point would be when Ukraine with launch its famed counter-offensive. They are talking of that for weeks, even for months. Okay, just admit that they are launching this counter-offensive. It failed. So then what? The EU has not the ability to support Ukraine anymore. The United States has no more the ability to support Ukraine, the more so if we are understanding that the intention of the United States are more and more attracted by China and by the problem of Taiwan. So at one time or another, I think it will happen during this summer. At one time or another, we have to retreat from value fundamentalism, and people in government in Kyiv will have also to retreat and to tell their population, yes, we say that we will have a victory against Russia. We couldn't. We need to negotiate.
I began this conversation by mentioning this fancy term, strategic autonomy, that French president used so proudly after his visit to China. Now, he immediately after using it got some reprimand from across the ocean. And in general, I think the French leader has a reputation of you know, talking too much and doing and not translating that exactly in policy terms, let's put it diplomatically. But do you think that was sort of an expression of Macron's own ambition and inkling? Was it all about his personality? Or do you see that as a potential within French policy? Can France be the one who will sort of put its feet down and say that, you know, we are going to be a nation that stands for its own national interest and for Europe's interest, independent of what our American allies want us to do?
Well, there is certainly a personal dimension in declaration made by President Macron. And well, we have to let that on the side because much could be said about the own personalities of Macron. What is true is that there is still in France a strong feeling that our interests are not the same than ones of the United States, even if they are not in conflict necessarily, but they are not the same, that even our interests are not necessarily the same that German interest, and that at one point or another, we need to push forward our own national interest. after that, how could we do that? Well, this is a discussion still going in front, as it is a discussion also still going in Germany and in different other European countries, because some people in Europe have understood that US national interests are not the same that interest of European countries and even of the European Union. So at one time, these divergence of interest will appear clearly.
Okay, when that happens, Professor Sapir, what would EU strategic autonomy mean in practical terms, given that you have severed economic ties with Russia, you are about to sever or minimize economic ties with China under the pressure from the United States, you have a mounting load of own internal, economic, political, migration problems. Can Europe stand on its own? Can it continue to exist without some powerful nation to lean on, be it the United States or somebody else?
Yes, there is some willingness to achieve this strategic autonomy. Some politicians are understanding that this strategy autonomy is necessary if we want that European countries and the European Union could survive. Now, how will they implement that? This is, of course, something we still don't know. I will also add a point. By publicizing too much this position, President Macron has probably undermined the very idea. Because, the late General de Gaulle has an expression. He said, well, it is not shouting, Europe, 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 like goods on a table, that you will make things to advance. Quite frequently, on this very important, but also very difficult issue of strategic autonomy, it's better to keep quiet and to make some decisions. The problem is that even if there is a kind of general agreement that some kind of strategic autonomy is needed for Europe, there is still a large difference and maybe conflict between countries like France, Germany, Italy, Spain. So we will have first to find a kind of agreement on these conflicts before we could act. And this is, the critical point to the European Union decision-making. That is, if we need first to have this kind of discussion between us before being able to move forward on the world, on the world level. So, of course, all decision making will be slow, painful, not exactly clear for other countries. And, it is not just the problem of Russia. It's also the problem of China and maybe also the problem of United States.
Now, can I ask you one last question, because our time is running out, but it's a fascinating one to me, because a few years ago you were lecturing a lot about the strength of institutions and the importance of efficient institutions within the successful economic system, the capitalist system, that is. And the assumption was that Western Europe has great institutions, Russia has awful institutions. But if we look at the way Russia has been able to pull itself together, both in the face of sanctions and in the face of this military operation with its huge financial, logistical, military supply demands, do you think that was actually an accurate assumption? Because it seems to me that Russia is far more efficient in facing these difficult times than Europe has ever been in recent history.
Well, Russia has quite obviously effective institutions, maybe not effective, open, or formal institutions. Maybe are they sometimes institutions behind the curtain, but still, they are institutions. And the problem now in Europe is that we have blurred institutions, because our understanding even of European institution is not the same. The Spanish government is not giving the same definitions of some European institution than the German government or the French government. This is also part of the problem. But I think that informal institutions in Russia have been particularly strong.
It's interesting. I think you're highlighting a very important difference between Russians, and we consider ourselves to be Europeans, and let's say Western Europe, because for you it's all about definitions. You are arguing about abstract concepts, and for us the most important thing is what works in reality. Yes. We are much more reality-based.
Yes, but informal institutions could work, and frequently could work in the short term better than formal institution. But in the long term, it's important to formalize what has been kept informal. And this is precisely where the Russian economy or the Russian society has a problem, because it has a very, very long traditions. You know, coming to the Tsarist situation, but even under Soviet Union, you had this divergence between official institutions and institutions behind the curtain. And we know that institution behind the curtain was frequently more important than formal institutions. It's more or less the same situation, of course. Russia is no more the Soviet Union. It's absolutely a different situation. But in this, you know, in this situation of formal and informal institutions, yes, I think that Russia is still very embedded into this idea that informal institutions are working more effectively. Not saying more efficiently.
Well, they're working more effectively for us. I agree with you. We are on a very different, on two very different sides of the spectrum, because you're putting all the value on formality, and look where it led your own union. I mean, it destroyed. It's ultimately the European Union is falling apart because of a very formalist attitude to itself. But Professor Sapir, we are out of time. It's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.